can hear Ian approaching. Is that you, Ian? Hi, come on in. Come in, come in. You found us. I know you don't normally come through this entrance. Ooh, sorry about the dogs. How very nice to see you. And you come in all your gear and you're wearing your hat and Jack is jumping up on you, which you would be naked, wouldn't you?
I would feel naked, yes.
Well, you would be.
Good point.
Oh, dear, that's dogs. You're going to be the first person to record in the Draycott sound recording studios. And I'm just going to give you a quick description of it. It's a garage, basically, with holes in it. And we've got nesting pigeons in there, guinea pigs, chicken food. So this may not be the quietest interview we've
done. It's so much more than an interview room. It's wonderful.
Do you think you'll be relaxed in there?
It's a home. It's like sitting at home, chatting with a friend.
Well, I'm sure your wife wouldn't really want you to draw the parallel of my scuddy garage to your home.
That's a good point. I shall make sure she doesn't listen to this.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. Let's go and get sat down.
Super duper.
So, Ian, I want to know a few things, and I won't be the only person to ask you this. How come you have ended up in our village? You're South African, and you're a postman in a small Somerset village called Draycott.
The shortened version is I moved over here 21 years ago to coach and play hockey. And as time passed, our daughter Tammy met a young gentleman from Cheddar, and she moved down here 6 years ago, or married and moved down. And my wife and I were offered opportunities to move down here as well, and we thought we'd like to be closer to her, with the possibility of starting a family and such like. So we ended up in Cheddar 6 years ago, and I was initially working in the Western Supermare delivery office as a postie. And then the minute that an opportunity arose in Cheddar, I leapt at it. And of course, the spin-off from that was that the Draycott Round is part of my patch, and it's become my permanent part of the patch. So 21 years ago, arrived in the country, began work as a postman at some point, and then ended up in the lovely village of Cheddar and working in Draycott.
And you are one, we have yourself and there's Roger, and I think there's a lady I sometimes
see.
So how many post people do we have allocated to Draycott?
On a good day, one at a time, but it could be any one of three or four from the office. Roger, who lives in the village.
Yes.
Who knows the area like the back of his hand. Myself, who has the responsibility of the round permanently. And then there's the young lady, Belinda, who you'll see from time to time, and then possibly Matthew, and there's another gentleman called Mike, who's just joined our office as well. And they will cover for periods when I'm on leave, when I'm off for one reason or other. And Sue, our manageress, whenever she is away or unable to run the office for one reason or the other, for my sins, that becomes my responsibility as well. So in addition to this as my permanent round and running the office from time to time, I also do a collection in Axbridge twice a week to help out with the shortage there. And I do the area training. So when new ideas, etc., come through the Royal Mail, I visit the offices in Wedmore and Axbridge just to share what the latest news or thing is as well. So those other duties will sometimes take me away from Draycott. But that aside, this is my permanent
home. But possessively,
yes,
we like to think of you as our postman.
Absolutely.
And we're very proud that you are. Now, I know one thing that people will be dying for me to ask you, so I'm afraid it may be obvious, but I have to ask you. You are a very dapper dressed post person, and including your hats. I mean, you said to me, when we sat down, you said, have I caused a disturbance in the village? And I said, well, I think there's a few fluttering hearts from ladies of a certain age when you come up their garden path, so to speak, wearing your bowler hat. Well, is it a bowler hat, or do you have an array of hats? And I've just been so blind, I haven't noticed the difference.
I do have an array of hats, but the bowler hat is the hat. So that takes pride of place on my head on a daily basis. But I do have a range of other silly hats at home, which...
Do you wear them at home as well? I mean, not in the house. I assume, well, that'd be weird. I don't know. You might do. You might.
Maybe
I might ask your wife about it.
No, they take... When the occasion merits it, a top hat might need to come out or...
A top hat?
Absolutely.
Have you worn that round the village?
Not yet. I'm waiting for a special occasion. There must be one somewhere soon.
I think when we publish your podcast, when it first goes out, don't you?
There we go.
I think that's
it. Splendid idea. I shall wear my top hat.
But there is some, I think there is a, did you say to me there was a kind of reasoning behind it as well?
Yes. Chief amongst the reason or reasons behind it is that it's a bit of fun and it makes people smile. And I think that's important. There's enough miserable in the world, and I think it's good to smile. So top of that list is, I think it makes people smile. B, I love wearing it because I feel quite at home with it on my head as well. And I want to make sure that in wearing it, acknowledging that I'm standing out for the right reasons, so that I'm doing my job to the best of my abilities.
Now, be warned, Draco. We may not, you know, you may open your door to anything. Be warned. But you were also beginning to tell me you also wear it because you want people to be aware of a charity that you're going to be promoting. Is that right? Something to do with assistance dogs, isn't it?
Yes. The charity itself is called Hounds for Heroes.
Hounds for Heroes, okay.
And that links in many ways into quite a lot of my life. You would think of Hounds for Heroes, you tend to think of the military, for example, and that is what they include. And the charity trains assistance dogs for former men and women of the armed as well as the civilian services. And
Who are they that train them? It's the
charity itself.
It is the charity itself, okay.
Hounds for Heroes. So, and they tell me that it costs in the region of £20,000. To train a dog from, I suppose, puppyhood and to the point where it's a functioning guide dog. And because I have a heart for members of the armed forces, having served myself, in addition to which my son-in-law is currently a retained firefighter. And
In Cheddar,
yes.
Oh, we see. Okay, yeah.
So the charity trains these dogs to assist men and women of the armed as well as the civilian services. And I thought that's a pretty good idea because it seems to me sometimes that the folk that protect and keep us safe often end up needing a lot when they do have inabilities to look after themselves.
So is it for veterans? Are they being trained for veterans? Or who will be the people that they are helping? Who are the people?
It would in effect be veterans of the military, but also the civilian, like the police, for example.
So what will these dogs, because Jackie's obviously, this is my guide dog, Jackie. I mean, she's trained to do quite specific things because I have sight loss.
Yeah.
Are these dogs trained in the same way or will they be trained to do different things? I mean, there are so many different dogs that do different things for different accessibility needs. Yeah. So
exactly.
That's what I'm trying to get to the bottom of. These are specifically to work, as you said, with veterans, but in what capacity?
You could be, or one could be forgiven for thinking that the dog was just trained to assist, and you're absolutely right. The assistance they would provide is for example, men and women who have lost the functioning of a limb or a limb.
Oh, okay.
And so would need help doing simple things like removing washing from a machine. But one of the areas which the dogs have a massive impact in as well is the psychological recovery.
Yes.
So the companionship and the friendship that a relationship between an animal and a human helps to mitigate in some way the feelings that are impacted psychologically.
Absolutely.
Having recovered from trauma, and that could be anything from having seen great trauma or, for that matter, having had a limb blown off, which would be a great physical trauma as well. So these dogs do quite a wide-ranging group of things, probably without even knowing it. So it might well be trained to do something we'd consider simple, like removing washing from a machine. But the companionship that it provides, it's quite difficult to measure the psychological healing.
No, I'm completely understanding, because when I got a guide dog, people always say to me, what has the guide dog given me? And of course, she gets me around things. That's what she's basically trained to do.
Yeah.
But what she has given me back is, I hate that word companionship, because it conjures up all sorts of, I think, rather negative things about people living their own, you know. Nice. And it isn't like that. But what she has given me, she's given me my confidence back. And also, for some bizarre reason, by giving me my confidence back, has made me want to now write and you know, do this radio series. So I completely understand that. And I think what they physically do is, in some ways, less important than, the, as you said, the what they do to improve your mental health.
Tiggy, I do a soup kitchen once a month.
Oh, I'll have some, thank you.
Throughout the winter.
Well, you're going to offer me soup.
If I was making the soup, you'd probably not want any.
Would you wear your top hat?
Absolutely. We do a soup kitchen once a month throughout the winter months in Western Supermare. It's organised by local charities, churches and other involved, and they do it at different venues. But the people that I've got to meet coming through those doors, I've met so many former men and women of the Armed and Civilian Services who are going through, who bear mental scars from what they've been through. And funny enough, a lot of them have dogs, just, I suppose you'd call them stray dogs. And it's made me think about the Hounds for Heroes and the raising funds for that charity. When I saw the impact of the dogs on these individuals' lives, giving them the companionship where no one else would care to talk to them on the street, giving them the confidence to walk into a strange place and say, I'm hungry, help, I need a meal, I need clothing, etc. So these men and women of our armed services, I think having sacrificed what they have, deserve a little extra help sometimes. And having witnessed the impact that a dog can make in their lives is what assisted in making me realise that Hounds for Heroes would be a good thing to work with.
I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? I mean, it's just, in a way, you think, well, why hasn't this happened before? Does it have any connection with helping the heroes? And I should just say, by the way, to listeners, we've now been joined by my chickens. Anyway, so any unseemly noises are not me and our fabulous Ian. So Ian, sorry, you were about to say then, I was asking you the question, does it have any connection at all with Help the Heroes run by people like Prince Harry?
It must do, in that they work in more or less the same field. Yeah. The peculiar old thing is that it seems like there are so many charities out there, all working towards a common goal. And I do wonder sometimes if it wouldn't function better under one umbrella.
Yes.
Why shouldn't Hounds for Heroes be working under the umbrella of Help for Heroes? And it's a good question that I just don't have the answer to.
Well, it's weird, though, because you say that, for example, with the RNIB, which is obviously for the blind, and then you've got guide dogs. You would have thought they were the same, wouldn't you? They're not. They're separate charities. And I think the problem is everybody is, you know, is trying to do it, the good thing, the right thing, but everybody's trying to get, you know, different charity money. And I think it is a challenge. But you were saying, though, you were going to do something quite remarkable to actually get some fundraising. Now, I'd love to just get a kind of a layman's view of a day in the life of a postman and what it's like working as a postman in Draycott. And are we good customers? Or do you come into Draycott and fear us?
I'm lucky enough to have something of a benchmark, if you will, to compare that with, because I've worked in Whitney and I've worked in Western Supermare and now Cheddar. And Whitney and Western Supermare, for example, are a world away from where we are in Cheddar, just by virtue of their size. These are offices with in excess of 150 postmen.
Wow.
Whereas it's a little bit like stepping back in time into sort of a sleepy hollow, coming into Cheddar, for example, where there are only 8 full-time rounds. And there's probably a staffing of 13 or 14 of us who make it happen or make it work, if you will.
Yeah.
And so the physically delivering in the rural areas, if you will, like Draycott, is it's such a blessing when you compare it to the busyness and the bustle of the bigger offices and also delivering in the cities. There's a slightly, I want to say slower, but I think it's a slightly better.
You can say slower.
It's a slightly better pace at which life functions.
Sure.
Um, So when I'm out in an area like Draycott, you feel that whilst the job needs to be done with reasonable pace, you do have time to stop and breathe.
Do you have a time constraint? Do they say when you leave the depot? Is there a time scale that you have to deliver to how many properties in a certain amount of time, or do you just have to get the job done?
Yes and no, and I'll see if I can answer all of that. The Draycott round is the longest round in the office, and it functions as what they call a nine-day fortnight. Trying to make sense of some of the functionings of the Royal Mail would be a mystery to the Almighty himself.
Yeah, I don't think I'll try.
Because it's the longest round in the office, I work 5 days 1 week and four the next, 5-4-5-4, hence the nine-day fortnight thing. Because of the length of it, and being as long as it is and taking as long as it does, it certainly takes a fair chunk of effort and energy to make sure that it's done properly. However, as I said earlier, it's nice to be able to you can forget the time taken when you realize that you're in a lovely part of the world. The people I think are friendly and polite and all of those wonderful things, so that offsets the time period that it takes to do.
But I know that you found out, because I was reminiscing with you about the experience I had when Roger, who was another of our local policemen, found me, because I'd just come out of the shower and I went to the door with a towel around me, and now whenever he sees me, he says, "Oh, nice to see you've got your clothes on, Tiggy," you know. But I sense as a postman there is quite a lot of nudity. Do you come across nudity when you deliver?
Well, I wouldn't say we go looking for nudity, but it seems to find us. And I was going to say, fortunately or unfortunately or not, in its various disguises, it's not been unusual to walk around the back of a house to try and find a safe place to hide a parcel for a valued and known customer, and come across people suntanning naked. It always makes you.
Does that happen in Draycott? We don't have to name names, but have you caught naked sunbathing in Draycott?
Myself, no, not personally. I often wonder too if some of the stories that get exchanged between colleagues of a morning, you do sometimes get led to wonder just how much truth there is in all of these things. They might be embellishing the story just to make it more entertaining, but you never know.
You never know. Yeah, I remember you did say to me, just do tell me again, because it was lovely. What was that? Yes. What was that story about that man? You said you'd delivered to a house and a hairy arm came out.
Yeah,
I had
the misfortune of delivering to a place, and it's probably safer to say in Weston-super-Mare, quite a while back, and a naked gentleman answered the door, and the reason I knew that he was naked was because he'd stuck a rather hairy arm around the corner to receive his mail and his parcel. But what he'd conveniently forgotten is that he had two frosted glass-fronted panels in his door, and he had the bulk of his nudity pressed up against this lot. Frosted glass aside, it still wasn't particularly pleasant.
Were you the arch professional?
Absolutely. Yeah. Handed him his parcel and walked away roaring with laughter.
Now, I have to ask you a question. I am slightly inept, so I'm sure it's probably me, but I deliver Christmas cards, as we all do once a year. So I'm probably around the village. I'm probably posting about 30, 40. And can I get them in the right blooming order? You know, I look in my bag and I've got, they're all in the wrong order. Then I think I've got them in the right, and I thought, I'll do so and so first. So is there, I'd love to know, actually, from sorting office to letterbox, how the hell does it work? And how do you manage not to get in a muddle?
Well, I wish I could say we don't, but we do from time to time. And even with the best intentions in the world, I think we put things through the wrong letter boxes, but we certainly get reminded about that.
Yes,
but there was a time when a lot of our mail was sorted manually, such that when it arrived at the Cheddar office from Bristol in the morning, we would all have to gather around and sort it into its different rounds. And then each postman in turn would collect the mail for his round and then sort it into a frame. And the frame is a device which we work loosely up against the wall, but it enables us to sort things by street and address, number, etc., so that we can then bundle the goodies up in the right order so that we can deliver in the right order. over the years, with an increasing move towards mechanization, we now have these enormous all singing and dancing machines.
How does the machine know that BS-27 is here?
They are far cleverer, far cleverer, far more clever far than more I clever. Could ever.
I think, well, they're far cleverer and far more clever than I am. How does something read a postcode, and how does that work?
It's staggering the pace with which these devices can read mail as it shoots through the system. I wish I could give you facts and figures, but I don't know them myself.
No, I don't want facts and figures. I'm just amazed.
But these machines sort post at light speed, and they scan and read the mail and addresses such that in the mornings when it arrives at us in Cheddar, probably 50 to 60% of it is what they call walk sorted, which means we can take a box full of it and put it straight into a frame ready for delivery without having to look at each piece of mail and find out where it belongs. At the moment, there's still about 40 to 50% of the mail arriving in the office which is not walk sorted. And so then that's up to us as posties in the morning to gather around and sort the parcels and sort the mail out so that we can get it into the right areas for delivery.
And so that when you get it to the village and you know that you've got your, you know, you've got your quota of mail for Dracon, what is your system? How do you work the village, so to speak? Do you work from the top to the bottom or the bottom to the top? What's your grid? How do you work it like a grid? And how do you have the mail ready in your hand or your bag? That's why I'm drawing the analogy with Christmas cards.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You try to be really efficient with how you have them bundled up so that, you know, you're not having to do a lot of scrabbling around. So how do you do that?
I'm a very simple beast, and I think perhaps that works best for a postie in that from the source in the office, it's all ready, or I bundle it in order so that I can work with it. And I very simply start on one side of the village and work my way through to the other side and go home when I'm
done. Are you doing it in postcodes?
I'm doing it by street.
Oh, okay.
By street or by streets, by a collection of streets. Okay. So I tend to start off with...
And I was thinking, as a postman, do you find yourself sometimes touching the grounds of social worker as well?
Yes.
Do you? Yes. And I bet you're lovely because you're so nice to talk to. I bet people, not just ladies of a certain age, I bet there's people all over the place who would love just to talk to you. And that must be difficult because you've got a job to do and you would love to be able to speak to lonely people. But do you feel the postie still offers a service of sanctuary for some people?
I certainly think it should. What we do as posties, at least the posties that I know, is the bulk of them are fairly sociable beasts. And would love to stop and chat because we give a damn about people, or I certainly do, and I know that the bulk of the rest of the people that I work with as well.
Definitely,
and we're rather fond of humans, which is why we work doing what we do. If you can't take time to stop and chat to another human being, then I think you're somewhat missing the point. As you may have asked earlier, you were talking about time constraints, and your current question links into that. Whilst we have certain hours and limitations within which we are meant to work, we're also encouraged to try and spend time with people as well.
They do actively encourage
it. Yes, the Royal Mail has rolled out an initiative in London, and it's quite funny because we were looking at this as Cheddar posties and thinking, well, that's what we do. But they've rolled out the initiative, and the initiative is that they are encouraging posties to spend time with the elderly, etc. Because the postman will sometimes be the only individual that will be seen by these folk. And so a little social interaction, a little human interaction is what is being encouraged. But that's what a lot of us do.
Really lovely to hear. That is such a positive message from the post office. You know, it's such a shame we don't hear more of that rather than them, you know, closing the smaller post office, because that is a really positive message, isn't it? Gosh, that's good. Ian, we're drawing to sort of towards the end of our chat this afternoon, and I know that you've only had a digestive biscuit all day, so I'm aware that you need to get home to your wife and children and eat something. I also aware that there were very few people available to do the post round today, so you've worked extra hard and it's the hottest day of the year. But I'm not going to let you go until I ask you this question. You are a bog snorkeler. Now, wait for it. Why?
there's Countryfile. I think it's Countryfile's fault.
Is it Countryfile's fault? You're blaming it on the BBC.
I have to. Yeah, definitely the BBC.
Yeah.
But I saw a program which contained snippets of these fools pottering around in a bog in a field in the middle of nowhere. And I thought to myself, that looks brilliant. I have to have a go at that. And so I discovered that they have the annual World Bog Snorkeling Championships in a bog, in a field, in Wales every year.
They do. I've got two friends going to it this year.
I believe I know them. Are they participating or spectating?
Well,
I'm trying very hard to encourage them both to
very well, and I'm not going to name names because I love them both dearly.
Good.
I think they're going as spectators, but knowing them both very well as well, I think when they've had a drink, they may well become participants. Good.
I happen to know who they are, but as you said, they shall remain nameless for now.
Yeah.
But I'm trying very hard to encourage them to don wetsuits and
yeah, what do you wear for this?
Well, the event itself is a bog or a ditch, if you will, is dug, a trench in a field.
Okay.
And the water from the surrounding field fills that up with whatever is in the field as well. So it makes it quite mucky and also very cold because it takes place over the bank holiday in August, which is not the warmest of times.
Mm-hmm.
And the course is 120 yards, 60 yards one way and then 60 yards back. And you are not allowed to use any conventional swimming strikes, and you have to have flippers, a mask and snorkel. Whatever else that you decide to wear in between is entirely up to you. And I've seen anything from sharks and camels to the 118 twins with the fairy great wigs.
Okay.
And,
So it's a bit like the marathon. People don on different things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And some of the more horrifying things, like those ridiculous Borat mankini
kind of
affairs, which they're not for the faint of heart.
No, they're not. They're not. Even that man you saw behind the glass in Western Supermare.
He was quite mild in comparison. And so all of these people from all around the world, quite literally, descend upon this bog.
Yeah.
And
So you say I'm not allowed to use swimming strokes?
Not conventional swimming strokes. Not
conventional. So do you walk along then?
It's about 3 foot deep.
Oh, okay.
And the technique for the pros, if you will, is to stretch the arms out as far as you can in front of you and kick like mad.
So you are swimming, your feet do leave the bottom,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. You're kind of torpedoing along.
And are you getting a face full of poo?
That's where the snorkel comes in handy, the snorkel and
of
mask.
Of course!
Yes.
Bog snorkeling.
Yes.
I'd missed that word, hadn't I?
You have to have a mask and snorkel.
But you can't see much, can you?
It keeps
Ian, can you play tennis or something or swim in the leisure centre at Kings of Wessex, something fresh and nice and manly?
It wouldn't be nearly as mad, and it wouldn't be nearly as much fun.
No, I can see that.
There are enough wonderfully mad things that the British do, which should never be stopped.
Do you wear your hat?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You do?
Yes.
You wear your hat while you're bog snorkeling.
I was interviewed by BBC Wales last time I won the World Over 50s title.
Oh, you are? So you are a champion?
Yes.
So you're the bog snorkeling champion of which year?
What are we busy with? 2019, 2017.
Are you going to try and keep your title this year?
I went back last year
in
2018 to keep the title. And this sounds awfully complicated, but I have a specialist snorkel for the occasion.
Of course you
which,
have a specialist.
Of course, who wouldn't?
Yeah. And, I have one in my bag.
Not that I'm serious about this at all.
Oh, okay.
And I have a pair of nose plugs which need to be used as well. And out of the goodness of my heart, I loaned snorkel and nose plugs to a fellow competitor last year. And she lost the nose plugs in the water.
She lost the nose plugs.
And that was what makes the thing function. So I had to scramble around and borrow some nose plugs from somewhere else, which I did. And off I went. But unfortunately, I'm blessed with something of a nose. And the plugs that I borrowed were too small and came off at about the halfway mark. So I ended up sniffing in water and other unpleasant things and choking and spluttering. So ended up finishing fourth instead of first.
So unpleasant.
It was. It was most unpleasant.
It won't draw me away from Scrabble, I have to say, Ian, I think. You know, I love the thought of it, but it is. So is it separated into sexes?
Yes.
Is there male snorkeling and female, which hence why she was buying the snorkel first.
Yes.
I was thinking, weren't you snorkeling together? But, oh, so it's quite... But why? I mean, because men are likely to be quicker bog snorkelers than women?
Well, it's an interesting question, and you may have thought that. However, up until last year, the world record was held by a woman. I just think that they make the division in categories, male and female. They have an over 50s category, and they also have an international category, which you can compete for.
And is there a prize money?
No, not at all.
So there's no really impetus to do it.
You get a little medal in the shape of a frog.
A frog, sort of muddy frog. You don't get anything except for a medal.
And a trophy.
Oh, you get a trophy. You missed out the trophy.
If you win, yes. I have a little trophy, which is three or four pieces of wood, which I think is glued and assembled together with a little stand saying, "This is the World Bog Snorkeling Champion Trophy." And little frog with a snorkel and flippers.
Do you know, I'm welling up thinking about that.
It's a very emotional thing, isn't it?
It's very emotional, and I might just have to take a minute just to digest this whole bog snorkeling thing. Now, Ian, I think, we've done very well, actually. I'm getting better at, actually, my timing. Otherwise, I tend to talk to people for hours and hours and hours.
So could
I. Yeah, and you are a joy, and a total joy to speak to. So, in summary, Ian... You had quite a kind of a dodgy start in South Africa.
Hmm.
Came over to this country. You worked very, very hard. You've moved your wonderful family to Cheddar. You've joined us as an absolute delight, as one of our amazing local post people. And I'd really like to say thank you to all from the community, because that we so need you and we so appreciate your work. I know we don't always show it. You're a charity worker. You know, you're doing this charity. Here, remind me the name again.
Hounds for Heroes.
Yeah. So we must all look at that. And all I can say is thank you so much. And just I hope you and your family continue to be really, really happy here, and that you are a postman for many, many years more.
Thank you, Tiggy. I'm very humbled and honoured. And it's a great privilege and a pleasure to be a servant, if you will, and helping look after the people of Draycott.
You have been listening to Draycott Diaries, recorded by me, Tiggy Trethowan. The editor was Rob Elliott, and the music arranged by Hugh Trethowan.